So, as I said before, we're going to carry on our series looking at parables from the White Lotus Sutra. And what we're doing is we're drawing on the myths and symbols of the White Lotus Sutra and talking about those. And tonight I'm going to be talking about the myth of the return journey. So I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But I'm going to start by reading a quote, and I may read it a couple of times. So, if you'd like to empty your mind and get yourselves into a receptive state. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people will not feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give others permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. So I'm going to come back to that later on. But it really inspired me when I was doing some background reading, so I thought I would open with that. So as I said, tonight we're going to look at the myth of the return journey. And this is part of the White Lotus Sutra. So it's one of the parables from the White Lotus Sutra, which is an ancient Mahayana text from the first century. So that's the first century common era, or the Christian era. And this sutra is very, very, well, it's very important. It's very central in lots of Buddhist schools. It's been very influential, very inspirational. So it's the inspiration behind the Tiantai school, the Tendai school, the Nichiren school, that's the Soka Gakkai tradition of Buddhism. It's also been very influential in the Zen tradition as well, so it's a very, very important text. And it's obvious from the start, when you read the sutra, that you're not in the kind of everyday world, you're not in the ordinary day-to-day world of things. So, for example, the Buddha that we find in the White Lotus Sutra is not the Buddha of the Pali Canon. You know, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha is, well, it's said at times that he's telepathic, that he has these sort of extraordinary powers. But this is taken to extreme in the White Lotus Sutra. So near the beginning of the sutra, we come across the Buddha emitting a beam of light from between his eyes. And the Bodhisattva Manjugosha says, okay, well, when I've seen this happen before, it means that he's about to expand the White Lotus Sutra. So we find ourselves in a world of poetry, of myth. It talks about a world that's timeless and inconceivable. And it also uses lots of very sort of it's like the language of infinity, I think. So it talks about you know, a world that was beginning and has no end, and it talks about some of the figures in it having lifetimes or which are dozens or koties of kalpas long. So does anybody know what a kalpa is? Can you explain what a kalpa is to us? Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So it's basically an unimaginably long amount of time, and a koti is an unimaginably large number. So if you imagine a koti of kalpas, it's certainly very large. So the traditional image that's ascribed to a kalpa is, some of you might have heard this before, that if you have a mountain, if you think of something, say, the size of Mount Everest, if you have a mountain that size made of marble, and every 1,000 years an eagle flies over the top of the mountain, and the tip of its tail just brushes this mountain. Well, as long as it takes that mountain to wear down, that's a kalpa. So a koti of kalpas is an extraordinarily long time. You wouldn't want to wait that long for the 38 bus. So it talks in this kind of language. It's fantastical, it's poetic. And as we'll see, as we'll talk about in the next hour or so, what it's attempting to do with that language is describe the enlightenment experience, which is ineffable. So it can't be talked about in day-to-day language. As soon as we start to pin down the experience of enlightenment, as soon as we even get close to it, if we attempt to use mundane language, then the meaning will evade us. So our only hope of getting even close to that is to use this language of poetry, of myth, of fantasticness. Is that a word, fantasticness? It is now, anyway. Okay, so what I'll do is I'm going to read Bante's summary of the parable of the return journey. I do recommend reading the sutra so that you can get lots of different translations of it. These are the ones that I've been using. And I do recommend actually reading the sutra, but I won't have time to read it all to you tonight. So I'm going to read in Sangharakshita's commentary, which is from this book. He gives us a very good kind of summary of the parable. So, they say that once upon a time there was a man who left his father and went away to a distant country. He lived there for a long time, perhaps as long as 50 years, and during all that time he was miserably poor. Roaming around, doing a job here and there, he lived from hand to mouth, and all he ever possessed were the clothes he stood up in. Meanwhile, his father was leading a very different kind of life. He was a businessman, and he met with such success in his various trading ventures that he became extremely rich. His trade took him from place to place until he finally settled in another country, where he continued to heap up riches, gold, silver, jewels, and grain. He had slaves and workmen and journeymen, horses and carriages, cows and sheep. He even had elephants. And in the East, if you possess elephants, you really are rich. He also inevitably had dozens of dependents and followers clustering around him in the hope of some reward. His influence in business, money lending, agriculture, and commerce spread far and wide, and he lived the life of a merchant prince. But despite his growing wealth and all his business activities, the rich man never stopped missing his son. How was the boy, he wondered. Would they ever meet again? Sorrowful at their long separation, his one hope was that one day his son would come home to inherit the wealth due to him. After all, the rich man thought, I'm getting old, and one day I must surely die. All this time the son continued to roam from one town to the next, from one kingdom to the next, until one day, quite by chance, he came to the place where his father was living, though of course he had no idea that he was anywhere near his father. As he was passing, or rather skulking, through the streets, keeping a lookout for odd jobs which would earn him a few coppers for food, he saw an enormous house, and sitting in the doorway, he saw what seemed to be a very rich man. He was surrounded by an enormous company of people, all waiting on him, or waiting for him. Some had bills in their hands, and others had great bundles of money that they wanted to give him. Others had presents, and maybe some had bribes. The rich man was sitting in the gateway on a magnificent throne. Even his footstool was ornamented with gold and silver. He was handling millions of gold pieces, just running his fingers through them, and someone was standing behind him, fanning him with a yak's tail. In India, a yak's tail is one of the symbols of royalty and divinity. So you would only be found with one if you were very rich indeed and had been exalted almost to the plane of divinity. Not only that, he was sitting under a magnificent silk canopy which was inlaid with pearls and flowers and hung all round with garlands of jewels. He was really a magnificent sight. When the poor man saw this rich man seated there on his throne in all this state, he was absolutely terrified. He thought he must have come upon the king, or at least some very great nobleman. "I better be off," he said to himself. "I'm much more likely to get work in the streets of the poor. If I stay here, they might make me into a slave." And he hurried away without the faintest idea that the rich man was actually his own father. But the rich merchant no sooner saw that the wretchedly poor man at the edge of the crowd of followers than he knew that this was his son, come back after all these years. What a relief! Now he would be able to hand over his wealth to its rightful inheritor and die happy. Joyfully, he called a couple of servants and told them to run after the poor man and bring him back. But when they caught up with the poor fellow, he was more terrified than ever. "They've been sent to arrest me. I'm probably going to have my head cut off," he thought. And he was so afraid that he fell to the earth in a dead faint. His father was rather surprised at this, but he began to see that all those years he had been living in riches, his son had been living in poverty, and this had created a great psychological difference between them. The boy was obviously not used to being in contact with the rich and powerful, but the faithful father thought, "Never mind, however low he may have sunk, he's still my son," and he resolved to find a way of restoring their relationship. In the meantime, things being as they were, he decided that it'd be better to keep his son's identity secret. He therefore called another servant and instructed him to tell the poor man that he was free to go. Hardly believing his luck, the poor man went off with all speed to seek work in the poorest quarter of the town. But he was followed by two of his father's men, chosen for their humble appearance. When they caught up with him, the men offered him work, as the rich man had instructed them to do. The job would be to clear away a huge heap of dirt that had accumulated at the back of the mansion, and the wages would be double the normal rate. The poor man accepted this proposal at once and went off to work with the two men. Day after day he shoveled the heap of dirt and removed it in baskets to a distant place. He found lodging in a straw hovel right next to the mansion, so close that the rich man could see it from his window. The rich man would often look out and think how strange it was that he should be living in a beautiful mansion while his son lived in squalor so close by. One day, when the poor man had been working at the mansion for quite some time, the rich man put on dirty clothes and, taking a basket in his hands, managed to have a talk with his son. "Don't think of working anywhere else," he said. "I'll make sure you've got plenty of money. If there's anything you need, a pot, a jug, some extra grain, anything like that, just ask me. I've got an old cloak in the cupboard, you can have that if you like. Don't worry about a thing. You've been working well and I'm pleased with you. You seem honest and sincere, not like some of the rogues I've got working for me. In fact, well, I'm just an old man, but you can look to me as your own father. I'll treat you just like my own son." So for a number of years, the poor man carried on clearing away the heap of dirt, and he got into the habit of going in and out of the mansion without thinking twice, although he continued to live in his straw hovel. Then it happened that the old man became ill, and he knew that he was soon going to die. He called the poor man and said, "If I feel that I can trust you completely now, just as I would my own son, so I'm going to hand over to you the management of all my affairs. You'll do everything on my behalf." And from that day on, the poor man was the rich man's steward and looked after all his investments and transactions. As before, he went freely in and out of the mansion, but continued to live in his old hovel. Even though he was handling all this wealth, he continued to think that he was poor, for as far as he knew, the money was not his, but his master's. Okay, so there is more. But to find out what happens, we'll first of all start drawing out some themes from what's happened so far. So I suppose the most obvious question to ask is, who is the Father, and who is the Son, and what is the palace and the riches? So just to say before you answer that question, it's interesting that this is a kind of it's a universal myth, the myth of the return journey. So you find this in a lot of different cultures. In ancient Greece, there was the Odyssey and the Aeneid. There is in the Bible, there's the story of the prodigal son. And this seems to be a myth that stretches across all cultures. So it's very, very interesting to start kind of picking this apart and think about what it is that it actually means in this case. So who do we think is the Father? Any ideas? So the Father is a fabulously wealthy man. So he lives in this palace, doesn't he? He's surrounded by more riches than we could possibly imagine. Elephants, jewels, probably peacocks. Anything beautiful that you can possibly imagine. And it's said that he's quite a sight. He's quite awe-inspiring when the sun first comes across him. Who do we think that represents? So it's a myth, it's a symbol for something.
Is it Buddha or enlightenment?
That's right, yeah. So it's the Buddha. So the Father represents the Buddha. So in that case, what do we think the palace represents?
Enlightenment.
That's right, yeah, absolutely. So the Father represents the Buddha, and the palace represents the principle of enlightenment. So the Father inhabits the palace, but he's not the palace itself. That's where he lives, and that's where his beauty comes from. Yeah. And what about the sun? Who do we think is the sun? That's me. That's right. It is me, actually. It is me, and it's you, and it's Subhadramati, and it's Alex, and it's all of us. So the sun is all of us. And the sun has become separated from his father somehow. Do you remember at the start of the parable we were saying that the son left his father and he went to wander in a foreign land, and he was wandering from place to place, and he'd become separated. So what does that represent?
Materialism.
Say again?
Materialism.
Materialism could be a form of it, yeah. So I suppose what it represents really is just that it's that alienation. It's a separation. So in a sense, you could say that the Father represents, well, as the Buddha, he represents our enlightened nature. And one way of talking about this is that the Buddha represents our potential. So in the parable, it's the Father and the Son is used as a symbol of that. So it's like he's of the Father, but he's somehow become separated from him to the point where he no longer recognizes him. So one way of thinking of this might be thinking about our potential. It might be thinking about, say, our higher nature or something like that. But the thing that it's trying to illustrate is that enlightenment is not separate from us, that we all have the potential for enlightenment. And this is central to the sutra. It's one of the key messages in the sutra again and again, is that any sentient being can gain enlightenment. that's open to all of us. We don't have to be special. We don't have to be a particular kind of person. It's our birthright. Any of us can do that. But as we'll see, it's not something that we can just sort of step into. So this image of the Father and Son, I think, is quite an interesting one. So it could be, you know, Father, Son, Mother, Daughter. But this got me thinking a little bit when I was preparing this talk. So my own father died when I was 24. He died when I was quite young. And at the time, I don't think I was old enough or mature enough, really, to sort of take on the full implications of his loss. But it's interesting that since I've sort of committed more fully to a spiritual path, in some ways my father has actually become more present to me. And in my own way, as I've moved towards enlightenment, or I've developed over the years, it's almost like my father has sort of become more real to me, because I can see in the sutra what a useful metaphor this is, that a parent in some way represents our potential. And a few years ago, I had some counselling, about 8 years or so ago, and had some counselling for about 6 months. And at the end of those sessions, I hadn't dreamt about my father until since his death. And at the end of these counselling sessions, where I'd resolved what was a very sort of big issue for me, I had this incredible dream where my father appeared, and he was absolutely radiant and beautiful in a way that I'd never seen him before. And this has happened to me a few times since. I've just been on solitary retreat for 2 weeks at Guyaloca in Spain, which is the men's retreat centre where the men in our order are ordained. And again, this happened to me on this retreat. And I'm not sure exactly what it signifies, other than there's some sort of process happening, and my father represents something in my journey. And initially, me making peace with him represented something. And it's like at each stage, as something happens with me, where he comes back to me in a very particular way, in a sort of a radiant, perfected form. So it's also interesting as well, I think, that in the sutra, the father never stops thinking of the son. So the father misses the son, and he thinks, what's the use of all these riches? He longs to share them with his son. So what do you think that kind of points to? What do you think that means? Any ideas?
He referred to the Buddha after his enlightenment, where he was pondering whether to actually go out and teach, and
yeah.
Whether he was wondering whether people were ready to receive the message or not, and then he decided, yes, he would.
That's right, yeah. So it's basically, as you say, it's pointing to the principle of enlightenment, that actually the Dharma is sort of activated when it's shared, or when it's taught to other beings. Yeah, that it's not that spiritual life is not a selfish pursuit. And in the context of the sutra, that's very, very important, because actually this parable is told by the Buddha's four chief disciples, and it's after the Buddha has explained this principle to them. So this principle of sharing the Dharma, that the ultimate enlightenment is actually gained through the sharing of the enlightenment experience. So this is the altruistic dimension of enlightenment. And the Buddha explains this, and the four chief disciples are so overjoyed to hear this that they spontaneously compose this parable. And they say, you know, it's as if a son has gone forth and he's been alienated for all this time. They feel so pleased at what the Buddha has told them, that there's this whole different dimension of enlightenment that they didn't know about and that they weren't expecting. So that's very important in the context of the sutra. So he's basically, it's pointing to the fact that in the sharing of riches, that's when they become truly the most valuable. That's what true wealth is in the sharing of wealth. And obviously, you know, from our perspective, the most valuable thing in the universe is the Dharma, is enlightenment. So just to go back in the story a little bit, so the son comes across his father. So the son is lowly. He's in a bad place. In the version of the sutra that I read, it said that he's a pitiful being. So he's got scabs and sores all over him. He's starving. He feels terrible. He doesn't have enough to eat. You know, he's a kind of a lowly beggar. And he comes across his father in this palace. And I think it's important to say that you know, what we are talking about here is a myth, but if we take this in context, particularly of the time when the sutra was composed or from when it dates from, how many people here have been to India? Yeah, lots of people have been to India. So you know what it's like in India. And this metaphor there, I think, is particularly powerful, much more so probably than if we think of poverty in our culture. So the difference between rich and poor in India is really, really significant. It's phenomenal. I spend a lot of time in India and I'm confronted by that a lot. And the sutra is not an advert for capitalism. It's not saying, look, you know, go out and become wealthy and all your problems will be solved. But what it's doing is it's using this difference of saying, you know, the son is in this situation and actually he could have a completely different life because his father is so wealthy. And that's what it represents there, is generally if you have money and you have education in India, your life is very, very different from if you're poor. I'm not talking about just a small difference. So you would think that the son would be delighted to find his father, wouldn't you? He's very, very poor. He hasn't got enough to eat. So he comes across this man, and that could be it, couldn't it? End of story, rags to riches, hello son, gold lame suit, off you go. But it doesn't happen like that. Maybe it could. I mean, do we think, for example, that the father should just give the son his wealth? Would that work, do we think? So he could just say, okay, look, you are my son, come here. You know, it would be like he'd sort of won the lottery or something, wouldn't it? Do we think that would work?
Your point is he's not ready for it. He's not ready to take on that wealth.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. He's not ready for it. It's so far from where he is now. And his mind has been conditioned by the poverty that he's been in for so long. So it's like he's become this different kind of being. And this is borne out in the sutra, because he doesn't actually recognize his father, so he can't actually see that this man is a member of his own family. He doesn't actually feel that he's related to him in some way. It's interesting, isn't it, if you think about this in relation to real life as well. When people do often go from having no money at all to having lots and lots of money, there's a lot of studies that have shown, for example, when people win the lottery, what they tend to do is they often end up in a worse financial situation than the one they've been in within a matter of years. You know, they'll give away the money, or they don't know what to do with it, or it causes them a lot of unhappiness, because, you know, people aren't used to it, and suddenly they've got this huge amount of wealth, and it's often they can't handle it. And in the sutra, it's not just that he doesn't recognize the father, he's absolutely terrified of him. So because of the kind of person he is, he suddenly finds himself in this palace, and he's a kind of a lowly beggar, so he feels that he doesn't fit there. I can't remember if it's in Bante's translation or someone else was saying that it'd be a bit like if you were digging a garden somewhere and you suddenly noticed that you were in Buckingham Palace. You would probably panic and think, what am I doing here? The security guards are going to get me, you know. So he's absolutely terrified, basically, to the point where he thinks he's going to be put to death. So the father's servants come after him But it's so far from where he is now that he runs away and he thinks, oh, there's nothing for me here. You know, I'd be much better off in a poor country. That's where I can beg. That's where I can do the things that are familiar to me. There's nothing for me here, in other words. So do we recognise that? Is that familiar to anyone? Yeah. Does anyone want to say anything about that? Any thoughts, any comments?
I heard someone say once that when the Dalai Lama was talking to a group of Western Buddhist teachers, that his surprise was the degree to which they were reporting that their students were struggling primarily with low self-worth.
Mm.
So that's what made me think.
Incredible
low self-worth.
Yeah.
Made you think he had no right to be there.
Absolutely. That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it was sort of Western psychological language. We would say that he's got low self-esteem, very low self-esteem. I mean, that's an understatement, isn't it? But he's got very low self-esteem. He's got a low sense of worth. But in spiritual terms, it's sort of like he doesn't yet recognize that this is part of his nature. You know, it made me think of my own experience of coming along to a Tri Ratna Buddhist center. So I first came along in 1997 to a center in Liverpool, and a lot of people sort of, well, it's interesting, isn't it? A lot of people say when they come to a Buddhist center, they say they feel like they've come home, which is an interesting way of talking when you think about it in relation to the sutra, you know, this myth of the return journey, and lots of people say that they feel like they've come home. For me, my experience was a lot less dramatic than that. I came along to accompany a friend on a meditation course, and I just remember thinking, well, this is all right, but, you know, there were aspects of it that I enjoyed, but I thought it's not really anything to do with me. You know, these aren't people that I can really relate to. They're not my sort of people. At the time, I was quite young. I was leading a very sort of hedonistic lifestyle. And I felt that I didn't really have much in common with most of the people there. I remember looking at... there was an order member who was leading the class there and thinking, well, I would never, ever want to do that. Why would I want to make that sort of level of commitment, you know? And I remember meeting mitras, you know, people who'd made the first kind of commitment, and me thinking, well, I would never ever do that. I would never want to become a mitra. But in a sense, it was just very, very far from where I was at that time. And I think, as you said, it's what it points to is in relation to the enlightenment experience. That's such a well, as I said at the start, it's such an amazing, glorious, kind of beautiful experience that with our small minds, we can't possibly begin to get our head around what that is. All we can do is take a step closer to it each time. And we each sort of do that differently, but as we get a little bit closer, we might begin to have kind of an inkling. But I think it's interesting, a lot of... I've heard people say often that... I've had conversations with people where they said, oh, I feel like I'm not making enough progress, or, you know, is enlightenment actually really true? Does it really exist? You know, I've been practicing for what feels like a while now, but I don't feel like I'm getting any closer. And I think actually what it is that if we were to taste enlightenment, we wouldn't be able to handle it. We wouldn't be able to sort of bear its magnificence. This put me in mind of an experience that I had a couple of years ago. So on my ordination course, I was at Guyaloka Retreat Center, as I was saying, the same place where I was on solitary retreat. a couple of weeks ago. And as part of your ordination, you're introduced to what's called a sadhana practice, which means you get given a special meditation practice on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. So I was introduced to this practice shortly after my ordination. And I think because I was in such a receptive, such a good state on that course, so I'd been on retreat for about 2 months or 2.5 months by this stage. So I was in a very, very good state and was very open and was having very clear meditations. And I was introduced to this meditation practice, which is on the figure of Virochana. And I had an incredibly strong experience the first time I did the practice, which nothing since doing the practice has even approached anything like this, where I was in such a clear state that I visualized this figure. And when it came to looking at the figure's face, it was so unbelievably beautiful that I actually couldn't look at it. And it's interesting, isn't it? We want that kind of experience. We think that what we want is enlightenment, and in a sense, that's true. We think we want to be closer to the Buddhas. We think we want to practice the Dharma. And in some senses, we probably think, oh yeah, enlightenment, I'm ready for that. But actually, when we get even within the vicinity of anything remotely as powerful, it's actually almost like trying to look at the sun without glasses or something like that. And I remember this experience very strongly, that the figure was incredibly beautiful. And it seemed to be both male and female at the same time. And it was the most attractive thing I'd ever seen in my life. But it was so attractive that it was almost like I could feel myself, although it was a sort of an imagined visualization, I had to look away. I just couldn't bear it for more than a second or so. Yeah. God, it takes me back just talking about that. So it was an amazing experience, but it also showed me that in my day-to-day life, you know, the reason why that happened was because I'd been on retreat for a long time. I'd been away from all the things that distract me. I was in a very, very positive state of mind, having just recently been ordained. But my day-to-day mind, my everyday mind, cannot handle the magnificence of you know, what it must be like to have really, really made progress on the path, the radiance and the beauty of that. Well, I was thinking about that story, and it put me in mind of there's another little myth. I don't know which culture this comes from, but about a frog. Has anybody heard about the frog that lives in the well? Yeah? So some of you heard this, some of you haven't. So there's once a frog that lived in a well. And one day this other frog turned up, and the frog said, "Oh, I haven't seen you before in my well." And the frog said, "Oh, that's because you know, I'm not from around these parts. I actually come from the ocean." And the frog was like, "What do you mean the ocean? I don't understand," because this frog had never been out of the well. And he said, "Oh yeah, the ocean, you know, it's this huge body of water about 10 miles that way." And the frog said, "What do you mean huge? Is it? Do you mean it's half the size of my well?" And the frog said, no, it's much bigger than that. What do you mean half the size of your well? It's way, way bigger than even your well." So he said, "What, bigger than my well? I don't believe it." So he started trying to explain to him how big it was, but in the end it was clear he just couldn't do that. So what he did was he said, "Well, look, if you want to hop along with me, I'll take you to the ocean." So he took him to the ocean, and as they approached it, they went over these sand dunes, and the frog caught sight of the ocean, and his head exploded. Because, you know, we can't handle it, and the frog couldn't handle it either. So for us, the fact that we can't handle it means that usually our response to something that we don't understand or that we're not comfortable with means that usually there's a kind of a fear response. And this is the case in the sutra as well, isn't it? The son's absolutely terrified. And I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, what was that like for me, or what is that like for me? And I was thinking about the way that my own fear has manifested over the years. And I remember very clearly when I first went on retreat, I used to experience a lot of fear. I used to particularly experience a lot of fear in silence. And it wasn't kind of simple fear. It was a form of like paranoia, basically, that in silence, I used to ricochet between feeling like everybody knows each other here, everybody's friends with each other, and nobody likes me. And I'm the only person that nobody likes. Everybody else is fine. I'm not okay. That used to happen to me quite a bit in silence. Thankfully, it doesn't happen very much anymore. Or the opposite of that would be true. Oh, they're all idiots. You know, I'm fine, actually. I'm the one who's fine. But nobody, what are they all doing? They're completely clueless. And it's just fear, isn't it? That's the thing. It's a totally natural human response that if we're in a fairly new environment, like being on retreat, it's quite a thing the first few times you go on retreat, because people are doing different things, they're behaving in different ways, they're talking about things that, I didn't used to understand a lot of the time. So that would be how my fear would manifest. So the son's terrified of the father and he runs away. And the father realizes that a straight-ahead reunion isn't going to be possible. It's not just going to be possible to grab the son and say, okay, son, you can inherit my wealth. The son's become this certain way because he's lived in a lowly condition for a long time, so much so that his mind's become accustomed to it. And what this points to really is the principle of Pratichasamutpada, I think. So we have this central principle that underpins all of the Buddha's thought, that everything arises in dependence on conditions. And of course that goes for the enlightenment experience itself as well. Enlightenment arises in dependence on conditions. We can't just step into it. You know, there are stories in Buddhist tradition of people having sort of so-called spontaneous enlightenment experiences. They may seem spontaneous, but of course they're built upon the conditions that have gone before. That's true of everything in the universe, in every universe, and it's certainly true of the enlightenment experience, and it's certainly true of our own spiritual journey as well. It's only possible to take that a stage at a time. So of course the Buddha knows this, the principle of enlightenment knows this, and in the sutra this is represented as the Buddha knowing that he is going to have a strategy. He's going to have a way of enticing the son. What's the word? There's a word that I'm looking for. He needs to, maybe it'll come back to me. He needs to sort of entice the son. He needs to offer him something that's attractive, that's going to bring him in. So anyway, what he does is, that's it. He needs to tantalize the son. That's what he needs to do. So what he does is he sends messengers, and the messengers offer him something. Now, in order that the son not be too frightened, the father sends his filthiest looking attendants. So it says in this translation that the men that he sends are two men of doleful and undignified appearance. So you can think about what that might look like. So he sends these men of doleful and undignified appearance. And they offer him a job. And they offer him a job for double wages, which is probably still a very small amount of money. But this is significant because it's something that he can actually relate to. So rather than these riches beyond his wildest imaginings, he basically gives him a job shoveling dirt, which he's absolutely delighted about. He thinks, oh yeah, shoveling dirt, I can do that. Double wages. So I might have just about enough to feed myself. So he's absolutely delighted. So I think this is significant on lots of different levels, isn't it? It's significant in relation to us in that initially what we're probably looking for when we come to the Buddhist Center, although we're not looking to literally shovel dirt, that might be what we're looking for in some regards. So what did we want? What were we looking for when we came through the doors of the Buddhist Center? You know, in some of the sutras, the Mahayana sutras, particularly I'm thinking of, there's a wonderful sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is basically about 1,200 pages of descriptions of the enlightenment experience. You know, kotis of kalpas of millions of different kinds of flowers, and innumerable sounds that are more beautiful than anything you've ever heard before. Immeasurable lands with golden waterfalls, with jewels and all of this sort of thing. That's not what most of us were looking for when we came to the Buddhist Center, is it? What were we looking for? Does anybody want to give me some examples? What did you think you were going to find?
Less
stressed. Yeah, that's really common, isn't it? People say, I'm stressed, I want to learn how to deal with my stress. Yeah. Anything
greater
else?
Awareness.
Say again?
Greater awareness.
Greater awareness, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
A way to abandon cynicism, but still comfortable, so you don't lose sight of how you see yourself.
Yeah. So you want to be comfortable, but you want a different way of being that's not so cynical. That's interesting, isn't it, as well, that you say that you wanted to be comfortable.
Recognizable.
Yeah.
Whilst going through that process.
Yes, yeah. So all of those things are very, very valid, aren't they? You know, I was sort of similar. When I first came through the doors of the LBC, I was having a hard time. I'd had a relationship breakup, I was in a bad place. And for a while, that this centre, this shrine room in particular, was the only place where I used to feel okay. I used to come here and I would feel happy, I would feel better. But I wasn't looking for these fountains and, you know, kotis of kalpas of innumerable beings. Now I'm really, really excited about that prospect. And that's definitely what I want to aim towards. But that's not what most of us are looking for. And in one way, we're sort of doing this on lots of different levels, aren't we? You know, the fact that when we practice, our lives can become a bit more manageable, that we can have a slightly clearer head, that we can feel more confident, more comfortable. That's really, really important. And in order for that to happen, we need to do some work, don't we? This is how we talk about it often, is people do work on themselves. We use this phrase, spade work. You know, has anybody heard that? You know, or we need to, the rough part of a task is called the spade work. So it's interesting when you relate that to the sutra. Because when we first come along, sometimes it can feel a little bit like hard work. It can feel like we're shoveling dirt a little bit, basically. I remember having a conversation with Jnanavacha there after I'd become a Mitra. This must be about 6 or 7 years ago, and I decided that I was going to commit to my spiritual practice, and I was meditating every day for the first time and was really putting a lot of time and effort in, and I was orientating my life around my practice in a way that I never had before. And I was suffering more. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. But actually, that can be a relatively common experience, is when we start to turn towards our experience, if we're meditating more, if we're becoming more aware, if we're reflecting on our life, what can happen is sometimes it can start to feel like hard work, because we've got, as the son has, he's built up all of these unskillful habits, he's become a particular kind of person, and when we start to become more aware of that and we start to work on it, it can feel a little bit like we've got a big heap of dirt that we're starting to shift. And that's a joyful experience sometimes, but it can sometimes feel a little bit like hard work. So the father observes the son doing this work, and he longs to end his son's suffering, but he knows that he can't just do that by force. The son needs to grow into being his heir. So it's like the father who represents the Buddha is incredibly compassionate, and in a certain kind of way, it breaks his heart to see that he's having to put his son through this. It reminds me a little bit of the story of Milarepa. You know, that it's said that the Tibet's great yogi Milarepa, when he first made a commitment to his teacher Marpa, he had to build these towers using these great big stones, and he would build a tower and then he would be ordered to knock it down again. And he would have these great big welts on his back, and he would be sweating in the sun every day. But he had to go through that process in order to be purified. So what the Buddha's doing is the father, as the Buddha, is raising his self-esteem. He's raising his confidence and his sense of self-worth, and he's getting his son used to being around the house, used to being around these beautiful, cultured, rich people, and he's increasing his sense of self-worth by doing that. And eventually, what the father does is he pretends to be a foreman. So he pretends to be working with the son. And initially, he's actually quite a hard taskmaster. So he behaves as the son would expect. And he supports him, and he gets to know him. And he says to him, don't think of going anywhere else. Stay with me. I'll make sure that you're looked after. You can have a new cloak. You can have oil and vinegar, as it says in the sutra. You'll have everything you need, basically. And so in this way, he builds up a relationship with his son. And over time, the son feels more comfortable. So do we recognize that from our own experience? What do we think that might point to? Any ideas?
Practice.
Say again?
Practice.
That's right, yeah. So it's the process of practice, isn't it? Yeah. And I think it's also like, earlier the father has sent messengers to kind of impart some important information to the son. And at this stage, the father pretends to be someone else. And the son recognizes something of value there, and he responds to it. And I think it's almost like when we come across teachers that inspire us. So we respond to somebody who seems to be a little bit more developed than us, or somebody that seems to have something that we don't have. And it's like the father is sort of taking on these incarnations, and that's what the son responds to. And eventually, he says to his son that he is like his son, and he adopts him. And actually what he does is he gives him a new name. And I think this is really significant. So the son has basically undergone a process to a point where, even though he goes back to his sort of hovel at the end of each day, he freely goes in and out of the house. So it's like he's comfortable around these kind of riches. And it's like at this stage in the parable, he's living on two levels. He's made some significant progress, and he's able to wander in and out of the Father's house, but he still goes back to his lowly sort of place at night. And I think it's significant that at this stage he gives him a new name.